This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Normal students want to have the same pointed conversations about guns with lawmakers as Florida teens did. Maddie Burns is one.
I feel like I should be worried more about my next social studies quiz or what high school is going to be like next year, as opposed to whether or not I'm going to die if I walk into those doors.
Plans for a school walkout mount, Ryan Denham reports. Plus, ISU theater student Francois Baptiste never needed his backup plan. Laura Kennedy talks about the art of acting with the acclaimed performer. And World War I destroyed much, but also gave Central Illinois the Caterpillar Tractor Company. Ryan Denham talks with a historian 100 years on. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The young survivors of the Parkland, Florida school shooting have been hailed for their public lobbying for stricter gun control. Now they're inspiring a group of local students to do the same. Unit 5 and District 87 are expecting some of the students to participate in a nationwide walkout demonstration planned for 17 minutes on Wednesday morning, March 14th. It's not just high schoolers. GLT's Ryan Denham visited with four eighth graders at Kingsley Junior High. Ellie Diggins, Ari Whitlock, Courtney Sims, and Maddie Byrne. They're planning their own walkout next week. Ellie says the Florida shooting inspired them to act.
I saw a lot online first, and I was thinking about doing it, but I didn't know like how Kingsley would handle it, how like my friends would react, because I know we have different views sometimes. But then once I found friends who also supported the cause, we kind of grouped together, and the more we researched about this topic, the more we wanted to do something to change.
Ari Whitlock, I'm gonna bounce over to you. Can you talk at all? What is the cause? What is it that you want to see happen?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to make schools safer for kids. The School Safety Act 2015, they talked about how a hostile or an abusive environment cannot be created in school. We feel like as students, since our lawmakers really aren't taking the incentive, it's kind of our place to. So we would like to have universal background checks, ban bump stocks, so people who are mentally ill and convicts can't purchase weapons, and pretty much ban assault rifles. Cause we don't see the point, and they're not for animal hunting, they're for people hunting.
Courtney Sims, you're one of Ellie's friends, a fellow eighth grader at Kingsley Junior High. Why are you so passionate about this issue?
For years, you always see shootings on TV and all this stuff. And after the Parkland shooting, it was one of the deadliest school shootings in U.S. history. And I thought, this is enough. And I saw movements all across schools around the nation, how they're doing a walkout. And Ellie wanted to organize a school walkout at Kingsley, and I thought that would be a great idea.
Ellie, I want to ask you, what were your emotions like after the Parkland shooting? If you could describe them, is it, were you angry? Were you sad? Were you frustrated?
At first, with all the school shootings since the beginning of the year, the first thought was like, well, yes, it's sad, but it just seems like one after another. But then I thought something needs to be done about this. It's February. It's early in the year, and we should be focused on.
We're campaigning. We should be campaigning for like bees by now, but we're campaigning for our right to not be shot at school. And since this was kind of the movement that was gaining a lot of momentum, we were already like kind of had these ideas like politically. We already were kind of behind this, but since this was gaining such momentum, we're like, this is the one that's going to change things. Finally.
Well, Ari Whitlock, I want to ask you, what was it like to see those high school students down in Florida so effectively lobbying for gun control in the media and in the public sphere? As a young person who's doing the same, what did that mean to you to see them having some success with that?
Well, I feel like the youngest generation always can make the most change because they're the ones who kind of get sick of the older generation that's keeping everything in control, and they're the ones that finally say no. the ones people before us have not done anything about it, but we're saying no, we're taking control of our futures. Just because we're not old enough to vote yet does not mean that we have no say. We too are citizens. It's our rights that are still on the line, and it's our safety. So it's important for us to have a voice as well.
Courtney Sims, what has it been like for you to see these Florida students lobbying so passionately on this issue?
Personally, I think it's quite inspiring to see kids as young as we are, almost slightly older, of course, stand up for themselves and try to make a difference in the world. While people who are making decisions for us and gun laws, they're older than us. This whole issue doesn't affect them as much as it does us, which is why I feel like high schoolers across the nation are standing up. And even though we're in middle school, I feel like we can still try and make a difference because it'll affect us in a few years.
We're going to be high schoolers next year. And then after that, we're going to be adults and we're going to be voting. And right now, we can't hold a position in office, but we want to change things that people in office can change, and we want to get their attention so we can be focusing on other issues instead of gun violence.
Because we'd be willing to talk to them, like Dan Brady, Jason Berickman. They visited our school, but there was more them to answer our questions versus us to kind of speak to them. What do you think about this? It was more of a student-teacher type thing versus an actual conversation. And I feel like we can, just because we're younger than them doesn't mean we're not accredited in our knowledge and our research. And I really feel like this generation, it's coming. You know, it's a force that's, I hope, going to change a lot for the better.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio today with 4 eighth graders at Kingsley Junior High School in Normal. They're Ellie Diggins, Ari Whitlock, Courtney Sims, and Maddie Byrne. They're planning a walkout demonstration March 14th, part of a national movement among young people to lobby for stricter gun control in the wake of the Parkland, Florida shooting. Ellie, what are you planning at Kingsley on March 14th?
So on March 14th at 10 a.m., which will be our second hour class, we will be walking out of our classroom and then out of the front door of Kingsley, holding some signs we made over the weekend, and we're going to do a somewhat silent protest, one, to not disrupt the learning environment that's still going on inside, but to also honor the students who and teachers and the people who have lost their lives due to gun violence.
So, Madeline, how about you? Let me ask you, why are you passionate about this issue? What brings you into the studio today, and why is this something you want to help organize?
Why I'm passionate about this is when I was reading the names and the ages of the 17 people who were shot, I noticed that a lot of them were 14-year-olds, and since I'm 14, it kind of bugs me or scares me the these kids who are my age exactly are being shot, and I'm just kind of watching, wondering, like, if my school is going to be the next one that gets shot up or, like, terrorized in some way, and I feel like I shouldn't be afraid of that. I feel like I should be worried more about my next social studies quiz or what high school is going to be like next year as opposed to whether or not I'm going to die if I walk in those doors.
Well, Ellie, I'm going to go back to you then. So I saw someone share a photo of a whiteboard, I think yesterday or the day before, a whiteboard showing the planning that you and your friends are putting together to actually do this thing and do this thing right. Can you talk about the planning process and what it's been like for you and your friends to put this together?
Yeah, around the beginning of this movement after the Parkland shooting, we had some Instagram discussions, and we were talking about, like, hey, so we heard about this walkout and the purpose of it, and I agree with this. And do you agree with this? And we started planning on Instagram and doing research there. And then we thought, since a lot of our friends actually did want to get involved, we wanted to have a whole meeting where we could talk about specifically what we're doing, why, and making signs to help with the walkout.
Are you worried about getting in trouble with the principal, the school, and what that might mean for you?
See, the Tinker versus School Board from Vietnam
war era, you know, they won the Supreme Court case, the right to wear their armbands protesting the Vietnam War. And from that, they said that students do not shed their rights to freedom of speech and freedom of peaceful protest when they enter the school gates. Thus, any repercussion, like Ellie is like Hermione Granger level, I don't want to be expelled. But there's a line where when the laws are wrong, you have to kind of disrupt what's going on to be noticed and to make a change at all. So I'd say that any form of school punishment wouldn't mean anything, and it'd be worth it, to be quite honest. Suspension is not the same as being gunned down at school.
So, Alita Diggins, I want to bring you into this. So you're the mother of Ellie Diggins, who we've been talking to today. What has this been like for you to see Ellie get engaged in this issue in this way?
I'm really proud of her. I didn't know that she had gone online and said, let's get this thing organized. So that was a surprise, but a very pleasant surprise.
Were you politically active like this as a kid, as a teenager, even today?
Not to this degree. I would write letters to the editor sometimes about things that I felt strongly about, but not the way that she is being right now.
Are you worried that she's going to face some kind of disciplinary action as a result of all this?
We've talked about it. I have told her that that's part of civil disobedience. You run the risk of running afoul of the authorities, maybe having a little penalty, maybe even sometimes if you're involved in a larger thing, a larger penalty. But this is something that she's decided she feels strongly enough about that it's worth it for her. And given her stellar academic record, you know, if she does get a little, you know, demerit or something, I think she has decided it's worth it, and I back her on that.
So you've probably seen that these teenagers in Florida, after they did something similar, they faced criticism for doing what they've done, lobbying so publicly for gun control. They faced some really nasty personal attacks. I mean, do you worry about Ellie that she'll be criticized for doing this?
I think that comes with the territory. Once you've decided to be bold and stick your neck out, then you don't take those things as personally. I mean, they're meant personally, but you just go with it and just say, no, it's all right. I signed up for this. And if you want to attack me, then that's what comes with the territory.
That's Alita Diggins, the mother of Ellie Diggins, an eighth grader at Kingsley Junior High. Ellie and her friends, Ari Whitlock, Courtney Sims, and Maddie Byrne, are planning a walkout demonstration March 14th, part of a national movement among young people to lobby for stricter gun control in the wake of the Parkland, Florida shooting. I'm Ryan Denham.
Similar demonstrations are likely at both Unit 5 high schools and Bloomington High School. The school districts say peaceful protesters won't face disciplinary action. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Still to come on Sound Ideas, 100 years of Caterpillar tractor. But first, the Smithsonian has declared 2018 the year of the tractor. It's been 100 years since John Deere bought the Waterloo Gasoline Engine Company. And now a 1918 Waterloo Boy tractor is featured in an exhibit at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. IPR's Michelle O'Neill reports tractors ushered in a new era of farming.
Whoopi's on the thrashing run. And I was the water boy. And we had a 1530. I think it was a McCormick Deering back then. 1530. And that thing, you'd load that thrash machine down and it would smoke like you couldn't believe, you know, because it fed it too heavy.
That's Bud White at this year's farm show at the QCCA Expo Center in Rock Island. The retired farmer in overalls from Wilton, Iowa, would have talked my ear off if I had let him. I also met Rollo Searle from Port Byron at the Antique Tractor and Engine booth. He says when tractors started to sell in the 19-teens, Deere & Company had already been in business for about 80 years.
John Deere did not want to have a tractor. He just wanted to build equipment. But the trend was that you sold things in packages. So Veeley, who was on the board of directors, tried to talk him into it, but they wouldn't have nothing to do with it. But I forget what year it was, but a bunch of the executives took a trip through the West and stopped the dealers, and everyone says, if you don't get a tractor, we're going to find a different brand. So they came home, and they bought the Waterloo Boy Company.
Peter Liebhold is a curator at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian. He says at first, hundreds of companies made and sold tractors, including Ford, which at one point captured 75% of the U.S. market.
Ford and International Harvester actually get into a price war and end up selling tractors at less than the cost of production. But what it does do is it drives a lot of great new ideas, and it gives opportunity for people to buy tractors. In the end, by 1930, Ford is out of the tractor business, and John Deere and International Harvester are by far the biggest manufacturers. They have about over 50% of the market.
At the time, Liebhold says the business of farming became much more important, and that's a big reason the Waterloo Boy welcomes guests to the Smithsonian's Year of the Tractor exhibit.
What we really love about Waterloo Boy is that it's a story of so many different intersections of technological innovation, but branding and competition and manufacture as well. So it's really just a wonderful piece and really marks the dramatic beginning of a whole era.
Another guy with stories to tell is Neil Dahlstrom. He manages Deere & Company's corporate archives and history. He says Deere started developing its own tractor around 1912. But about 6 years later, it didn't meet the high bar the company had set.
Deere engineers had seen Waterloo Boys in operation during all of their R&D over the previous 6 years. But we found out through a third party they were potentially available. We sent representatives up there, talked to them. Our board of directors talked about the acquisition. And we were told by the president at the Waterloo Gasoline Engine Company, we need your decision by tomorrow or the offer's off the table. So you think about a big company making decisions quickly. They had to make a decision quickly. And they wrote a $2.1 million check.
Deere started advertising the Waterloo Boy as a good tractor backed by a permanent organization.
It's the, you know, the putt-putt, the Johnny Popper, the whatever you want to call it. It's an iconic sound, so that's kind of part of the package that you want to present. You know, a lot of people can listen to it and they can tell you what model it is based on the sound. The Deere story is not just a Deere story. These pieces of equipment go out into the world and they take on a new persona. They kind of get a life of themselves, and it's how customers use them and adapt them. They kind of become part of the family, which is pretty amazing. I don't know a lot of other companies that can say that.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Continuing the tractor theme here, World War I remains one of the deadliest and most destructive efforts in human history, with tens of millions of casualties. But the Great War also helped create something, too. Caterpillar, a company that remains one of Central Illinois' most important employers and its top global export. GLT's Ryan Denham visits with historian and archivist Lee Fosberg from Caterpillar about World War I ahead of his March 13th presentation at the McLean County Museum of History.
Caterpillar really became the company that it is today because of World War I and because of these two companies. So Caterpillar really came out of the Northern California area. It was two family-run companies. The first was the Holt Manufacturing Company. It was run by a person named Benjamin Holt, and he was the inventor of what we know today as the track-type tractor, or what we call dozers. And it came out of the world of agriculture. And he first invented combine harvesters that were originally pulled by horses. And through technology and efficiency, it was like, how can we make this, you know, more practical? And he invented steam tractors that had wheels, but because of the environment of where they were in Stockton, California, the track-type tractor took off, and he was really the person behind that. The other thing that he coined the phrase was Caterpillar, and that was the trademark of his company. And when it ended up merging with another company, that was the name that the companies took.
What's this other company that comes into play, the C.L. Best Tractor Company?
It's kind of an interesting story with Best in that C.L. Best was the son of a person called Daniel Best. And Daniel Best was actually a big competitor with Benjamin Holt. He had a company that was in San Leandro, California, which is a little bit closer to Oakland. And he made steam tractors, he made combine harvesters, but he had a 13-year-old son that worked for him, C.L. Best. And what he ended up doing was selling out his company to Benjamin Holt with the idea that C.L. Best would run that company as a subsidiary. Well, C.L. Best ended up having a falling out with Benjamin Holt, and he created his own company. And that company kind of leads us up to World War I. And so you had Holt as a big competitor in the world of track-type tractors, and you had C.L. Best as a competitor in track-type tractors.
How do both of these companies get involved in World War I and the war effort?
It's interesting is both companies were vying for, you know, government business for the war, just like a lot of companies were. Now, the track-type tractor was used to pull and haul things, in like artillery pieces, wagons. Where Benjamin Holt had a step up on C.L. Best was he had a much older company. It was a much larger company. So they were able to show to the government they should get the government contracts. Best was a small startup company. He was not able to get the government contracts. But what he was able to get from the government was the assurance he could still build tractors. Because you're talking about a time that steel and things for government use was in short supply. Because, again, these were agriculture tractors. He was able to keep on selling to the domestic market, where Holt totally switched over to the government. And most of those tractors were actually made for the war effort right here in Peoria.
Is this just the American government we're talking about, or was this equipment going to foreign governments as well?
Well, you know what? It was going to both. And actually, Holt was selling these products. You know, the United States really got into the war at very late and weren't really in it that long compared to the other European powers. But Holt was selling to the British, the French, and the Imperial Russia before the United States got into the war. So these products had been used across the, you know, the European theater and the African theater, you know, way before the U.S. got into it.
So am I picturing this correctly? This is equipment that was built for agricultural use, but it's being used in wartime to, like, drag around heavy artillery?
Absolutely. And what you're kind of learning out of this, right, it's now starting to be used for other applications. And, you know, how we think of Caterpillar today, right, we're in construction, we're into moving earth. The beginning of that you first start to see is during this era of World War One. And then after the war, you start to see, because of, you know, the modern automobile and stuff, you start to see that the tractor's starting to be used, you know, in road building. And you could really trace the roots back to World War One as where a watershed moment of where these started to slowly flip to being used for non-agricultural purposes.
How does all of this pull these two companies together, closer to merger, and ultimately the Caterpillar that we know today?
Well, really what came out of the war, I think, are several different things. One is Peoria really became the center of track-type tractors being built across the world, because originally, when Holt came to Peoria, they had less than 20 employees, I believe, in 1909. And the numbers, because the plant expansion to create tractors for the war effort, you know, it doubled and tripled in size. So it really set the East Peoria plant as being the main area of production. The other thing is, because Holt became so bogged down in creating tractors for the war effort, there wasn't research and development going in on their product, and C.L. Best was able to take over the domestic market. The other thing is he came out with a revolutionary tractor during this time period called the Cat, or which was the Best 60, and ended up going on the Caterpillar line. And to give you an idea, the genetics of that tractor are still on our line today in the D8. So he came out with this revolutionary tractor, and when the war ended, Best was able to take up that market share. And to give you an idea, Holt was 6 times bigger than Best, but Best was more profitable. So in 1925, it kind of made sense that these two companies merged. Holt had like a worldwide name of Caterpillar, and we always like to give the example is everyone called track-type tractors Caterpillars. It was kind of like Kleenex of facial tissue. But Best had this great machinery, and they had a great management team. So when they merged, you found that you had the best management team. C.L. Best was our first chairman. They called the company Caterpillar, and they kept the East Peoria plant.
So it's at that time that Caterpillar becomes more of a household name?
Absolutely.
What happens in World War II?
Well, you know, World War II was like another watershed for our equipment. So before, even, you know, we were still, I would say, an ag company, though our equipment was being made for moving earth. But really, by the end of the war, we were an earth-moving company. We'll make the analogy to that we were kind of very much the company that we are today after World War II, because it was really in World War II where people learned how advantageous it was to have a dozer blade on a machine. And really, it was recognized like the bulldozer as being just as important as things like the submarine and the aircraft carrier, you know, because, you know, they stormed the beaches of Normandy. They were made to build airports across islands in the Pacific. And then after the war, you know, this equipment was across Europe, and we then started building plants and stuff because people knew our brand, and it brought our brand really overseas.
Did Caterpillar have any significant role in more recent war efforts? Vietnam, Korea, Desert Storm?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that probably any U.S. kind of conflict, our machinery, you know, has been there to support the effort.
You'll be speaking March 13th at the McLean County Museum of History, talking about Caterpillar's history as it relates to World War I. This is a time when Central Illinois relies heavily on its largest employers like Caterpillar, State Farm, ADM. Everybody's kind of looking for signs about their plans for the future. So what do you think we can learn about Caterpillar's future by looking into its past?
The thing that we like to tell the story is a lot of people, you know, outside of CAT and inside of CAT, think that really this global product and this global brand is kind of more of a recent thing, more of a World War II thing. And a lot of people don't really realize that over 100 years ago, I mean, our machines were on every continent but Antarctica. And now we kind of talk about our machines are on every continent, including Antarctica. And I think really the past will tell you a little. If you look back to the past, it'll give you an idea where how you can tell stories in the future, because it's really, in certain ways, not all that much different.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, speaking with Lee Fosberg, Supervisor of Heritage Services at Caterpillar. So, Lee, how does one become a historian, an archivist, for one of the largest companies in the world?
Well, an archivist is really, you would say, an interdiscipline between kind of the realms of history and library science. You know, you need the background of a historian to kind of select and do things and have the knowledge of history. And then the library science part is right. People ask for stuff from us, and we have to be able to find it. We're information managers. And so it's kind of the degree that I got was a master's degree that was both in history and library science.
Why is it important for a company to know its own history and to share that history?
Well, you know, the one thing that we like to always tell the story is one of our former chairmen, he used to always say that our history is really differentiates us between us and our competitors. So in a very kind of, you would say, subtle way, it helps us to sell machines, and we can say that we've been doing this over 100 years, and we've been doing this, you know, better than everyone else.
People may have this vision of archivists who only work in a museum or in academia. What's it like to be a historian and an archivist for a company? Because you've sort of done it all.
I would say the big difference is this. At a corporate archives, we are very much, you know, we do have, you know, internal research, we do external research, but really where we add value back to the company is the storytelling that we do. So we really act both as kind of a communications function, but we also act as a marketing function. So, for example, anything that you see that runs like off of Cat social media, and the stories, and a lot of times the video, was all developed within our team.
That's Lee Fosberg, Supervisor of Heritage Services at Caterpillar. He'll be speaking March 13th at the McLean County Museum of History, talking about Caterpillar's history as it relates to World War I. I'm Ryan Denham.
If you want more local history, the McLean County Museum of History will host The Walls Speak, Illinois State University's story, through its campus buildings on April 7th. You can find more community events at our website, wglt.org.
NPR One is a whole new way to listen.
I like that it mixes things for me automatically.
Catch up on NPR and GLT News. Customize the app for you.
It looks at the content that I'm looking at, I think. It feels like the thing is starting to anticipate things that I might like.
Share what you like. Skip what you don't. It's public radio made personal.
Hi, I'm Greg Kosorik from Bloomington, Illinois, and I listen to NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at wglt.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is building a gig speed network providing small businesses across the country with the opportunity to dream gig. More information available at dreamgig.com. Comcast Business, built for business. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan continues to have problems with the Me Too issue. Many research labs across the country use animals to test products such as makeup or medicines. For the past decade, advocates have pushed to get more of these animals adopted after they're no longer needed. Just a handful of states have policies in place. Illinois recently joined the list. IPR's Daisy Contreras checked in with an Illinois family to see how their rescue beagle has adapted to a life away from the lab.
During playtime outside, two beagles are barking as they run. There's also a third, smaller beagle who doesn't bark or make much noise, running not far behind.
Hi, Lucy.
Her name is Lucy, and she was rescued from a research lab last year.
Was she always this active?
Yeah, she. When we first got her, you know, with all the pacing, she was definitely very, very active. The first day we got her, I even did running, I think, in the yard with them.
That's Laura Knudsen and her husband Scott, who live in Winnetka. Lucy runs and follows the other two dogs, but she can't copy their bark. Laura and Scott say they believe Lucy's vocal cords were damaged during her time in the lab. They have no idea what lab Lucy grew up in or what kind of research she was used for.
All the rescued dogs behave differently, so it was nice to see that she was able to run and she wasn't fearful of people so much. So whatever was going on with her in the lab, she may have been exposed to more people. She was just very curious of everyone and everything.
Laura and Scott fostered Lucy from the Beagle Freedom Project, an organization based out of California. So far, the group has rescued over 1,000 animals from research labs in 36 states and 7 countries. Kevin Chase is the group's vice president. He says if dogs like Lucy aren't rescued, they would most likely be put to sleep.
The standard operating procedure in the research industry is to kill these animals, even if they're healthy, when the research is done.
The Beagle Freedom Project is pushing for nationwide legislation to stop this practice, at least when taxpayer money is used to fund the research, like at public universities. This year, Illinois became the sixth state to adopt the so-called Beagle Freedom Law. It encourages labs using public funds to have some type of adoption policy in place. About 65,000 dogs are used in U.S. research labs each year, the majority beagles. The law also includes cats, but not many make it out of research projects alive. In Illinois, it took 2 years to get enough support. Advocates like Chase say the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and their labs were probably the strongest opponents.
They were worried that this would have a chilling effect and people would no longer use dogs and cats in research.
But Robin Kaler, the university spokesperson, says the new policy doesn't apply to them and never did.
We already had a policy of adopting our dogs and cats out, so it doesn't affect us.
Kaler says the university adopts its healthy research animals out to university employees and students. She agrees there were some issues with the original legislation, which may have kept the school from supporting it much earlier. Chase says changes were made to reach an agreement.
The compromise was that we did not put in the bill which organization that the universities had to work with.
He says in case a suitable home can't be found within the university, the new law will be a safety net, just to make sure animal rescue groups are called to take the animals in. Laura and Scott from Winnetka drove Lucy the rescue dog to Springfield last May to meet with lawmakers to make sure the Illinois bill passed, and other beagles joined them there.
Unless you actually see the beagles and meet the beagles, you know, it's hard to really understand what this is, you know, all about. So definitely a lot more powerful if, you know, the different politicians we're meeting with are actually getting to see the dog.
Putting her advocacy career aside, Lucy continues to settle in with her new family. Laura and Scott say they are happy Lucy joined them and their two other dogs. This way, they say, Lucy can now learn how to be, well, a beagle away from the lab.
I mean, she's a little smaller than most beagles. She's a little bit more petite.
Yeah.
I think we kind of say, you know, she still looks like a puppy. She's very just kind of high energy. I think she's very curious, very friendly and kind of outgoing, but she has this mysterious side to her that you can't quite put your finger on that occasionally kind of shows up that I think always reminds us of the lab, but she is a really, really sweet dog.
Yeah, definitely. So sweet.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Laura Kennedy's interview with an ISU alum who's making it as an actor. On Tuesday, Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan issued a statement saying that he would personally deal with anyone accused of sexual harassment on his watch. It's the latest attempt by the Speaker to get out in front of an issue that continues to dog his leadership. Madigan has been scrutinized for how he's handled harassment allegations, including in the state political organization he oversees. IPR's Maureen McKinney talked to several political observers to see how this might affect Madigan's future in government and politics.
The Speaker has had the letter for 3 months. It would take all of 20 minutes to know that that was sexual harassment.
That comment by Elena Hampton is essentially Mike Madigan's Me Too problem. Hampton was speaking at a press conference the day she filed her complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Her point, that it took far too long for Madigan's staff to act on her complaint of sexual harassment by her boss. He's Kevin Quinn, the brother of Chicago Alderman Marty Quinn. The alderman, by the way, oversaw his brother in the campaign organization and heard Hampton's disclosure a year ago, February. She made her complaint to Madigan's office last November. Madigan acted, but it happened as the Chicago Tribune was about to publish a story involving Hampton. Several of the political scientists and political writers we spoke to for the story agreed that once the March 20 primary is over, Madigan may have reason to worry about how likely he'll continue as state party chair. He's done that job since 1998 and has been speaker for all but 2 years since 1983. Dick Simpson is a political science professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
There seems to be considerable pressure arising to have him replaced as head of the party in Illinois, but not before the March 20th primary.
It certainly doesn't look like there's any chance of Madigan leaving the party chair or the speaker's job on his own.
I'm not resigning. I'm moving forward. I'm working with this particular issue, and we're going to work our way through it.
But Me Too is different from the usual political fires Madigan has put out. Rick Pearson is a Chicago Tribune political writer.
This is a movement that is just so big and so all-encompassing that it's not a movement that can necessarily be controlled in the conventional way that other issues are controlled in politics.
Chris Mooney, another political science professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, says Madigan is a skilled politician who has avoided scandals, but that Me Too movement is out of his wheelhouse.
This is sort of a curveball, and I guess we can see, can he hit the curveball?
Depending on what happens, Me Too could be what eventually leads to Madigan's exit. But Chicago Sun-Times columnist Mark Brown says the catalyst for the departure of Madigan might be if more harassment complaints become public, or it could be a large contingent of women calling for the speaker's resignation, or it might even be a new Democratic governor who wants a bigger role in party politics.
The House Democratic Caucus, where he actually has, he probably has more enemies because they, there's a lot of people that have been chomping at the bit for a lot of years, right? You know, chafing under, you know, his sort of autocratic style. There's a lot of people there that, that might be willing to step up.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As a student at Illinois State University, acclaimed actor Francois Baptiste always had a backup plan. With a double major that included theater education plus some minor in English education, he was prepared to make a life outside of acting as a teacher if necessary. Swift success, though, on the stage and screen ensured his backup plan never had to go into action. That didn't mean he was done with school. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Illinois State University honored one of its own recently by inducting Francois Baptiste into the College of Fine Arts Hall of Fame. The graduate has had a varied career in theater, film, and most recently, TV, on the ABC series 10 Days in the Valley. After graduation 20 years ago, Baptiste followed many other Redbird actors by heading up to Chicago, where he very quickly found stage success. He also soon realized that he needed something more and headed off to Juilliard to extend his knowledge base.
I wanted to find out what the world had in store for me, and I knew in order to be as exceptional as some of the actors that I saw, I needed further training. See, when I got to Chicago, when I graduated Illinois State, I was 21 years old, and at that time, I still didn't know if I was going to be an actor. Yeah. I was double majored in theater and theater education, minored in English education, emphasis in communications. And I'm like, well, these are my fallback tools in case I need to be a high school teacher. And so when I graduated college, I just didn't know if this was the thing that I was going to pursue ultimately. And then I was fortunate enough to start working pretty quickly in Chicago. And I just realized that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life there. I wanted to see what else the world had. I wanted to pursue, and I wanted to cultivate whatever I had. Because at 17, 18, 19 years old, you are in a theater department, but you're not really sharpening tools. You are getting your feet wet. You're being immersed in the world.
You're acquiring the tools.
You're acquiring the tools, but they're not really sharp enough to carry you through. That's what I felt. So I needed to go to grad school, and I needed... Well, I didn't need to go to grad school, but I wanted to go to grad school because I wanted to get out of Chicago, and I wanted to go to a city that had bigger and brighter, and that would have taken me to the West Coast or to the East Coast.
Well, once you got to Juilliard and started learning the lessons you were looking for, you won the Hausman Award, which is very prestigious. You were actually the first African-American to win that award. What did it mean to you to win that award? Did you feel justified in the choice that you made?
I was grateful, and I guess there was some sort of sense of validation at the time. A school like that, you just want to make sure that you have to take ownership of your process, because you're in a school with immensely talented, very talented people. And sometimes you get swept up in the world of thinking that just by being here that you've made it in some form or fashion. But having had 3 years of professional experience prior to going, I realized that this is just training. You have to take advantage of your training, and you have to acquire a sense of tools that you're able to use for the longevity of your career. And so that to me, receiving the award, just meant that I was on the right path.
Let's talk about some of those tools. Before we sat down to do the interview, we were talking about what an actor needs to be a good actor, and you mentioned empathy. Yeah. How important is empathy for an actor?
The ability to place yourself in other people's shoes and objectively see their circumstances is incredibly important. If you're not able to do that, you'll be stuck in judgment. You'll be judging the person that you're attempting to portray. I think it's less about trying to judge that person than it is about understanding that person and what is making that person behave in the way that they're behaving, say the things that they're saying, feel what they're feeling. And in order to do that, you have to have some kind of moral compass to open up and see really what has placed that person in those circumstances. So I believe along the social tapestry, if we're able to do that, we will have more opportunity to see how and why society in certain pockets is the way it is.
In 2014, you co-founded the Collective Theater. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, the Collective Theater Company, and you did that along with another ISU alum, the late Nelson Ellis. Can mm-hmm. you tell me why you decided to do this? Were you trying to create opportunities for yourself to explore characters that you had in mind or to try new things? Did you see a void in the theater landscape in Chicago that needed filling?
Great question. Let me try to answer it this way. The reason why I became a student here at ISU is because when I was in high school, I did speech team and group interpretation, contest playing, things like that. Well, when I was in high school, we did a group interpretation called The Colored Museum, and we won the state championship. And as a result of that, we were asked to perform down here at ISU. Upon walking directly out of the door, I was stopped by a professor or two who asked me to come to ISU. We have scholarship opportunities and things like that. And so that really informed my decision to make it ISU. Well, the other ensemble members are still my closest friends. And so the people that were in that ensemble of that group interpretation, you know, 15, 20 years that we've been talking about starting a theater company in a way that we can bring some kind of change, some type of impact to the city of Chicago and tell some stories that haven't been told. Be a theater company that can tell stories that are relevant, but also mix in the classics and tell them in a new way. So that's pretty much our aim of creating the Collective Theater Company.
Well, you are quite good with the classics. You've done a number of classics, like you were in The Merchant of Venice.
Correct.
In New York with Al Pacino. And you won an Obie in New York for The Good Negro.
Correct.
And you're on TV now. 10 Days in the Valley.
Correct.
Is the name of the TV show. You're Detective Gus Tremblay.
Yes.
I want to know, what's the appeal of TV for you? There's a lot of really good television out there right now on a variety of platforms. So what does that appeal for you when you have such a strong theater background?
Well, I mean, the most succinct way of answering that question is my bank account loves film and TV.
You want to put your kids through college.
Exactly. My heart loves theater. I have grown to love and appreciate all mediums, television, film, theater. They're different muscles of the same body, different muscles that you exercise. There's a little bit more technical things that are you have to worry about in television and film. But in theater, it's kind of like it's a communal experience.
The audience there becomes part of the performance.
That's
because they have because of their energy.
Right. There's a reason why theater has survived thousands of years, and it's because we're in the same room with hundreds, sometimes thousands of people sharing an experience, and it's storytelling. I learned a few years ago that, and this may be off topic, but I learned a few years ago that Sophocles was not necessarily a playwright. You know, Sophocles was a general, and he ended up writing plays as he came back from the wars to educate the mass on what soldiers were experiencing in battle. And that's why he started to write plays. That's how you got Ajax and things like that, because he was off to war for 8-9 years at a time, came back and decided that many people in Greece didn't realize the type of psychological injuries that they were enduring. And so he would write these plays to try to tell the stories. And this was thousands of years ago.
And we're still telling these stories.
We're still telling these stories so that we can educate the mass on what individuals are going through. And Shakespeare said it best, you know, hold a mirror as 'twere up to nature. You know, we just want to reflect what is happening in society. We are still telling these stories, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to do that.
That's actor Francois Batiste, just recently inducted into the Illinois State University College of Fine Arts Hall of Fame. I'm Laura Kennedy.
This spring, Batiste heads back to the boards in New York City, where he'll perform opposite Blair Underwood in a new play entitled Paradise Blue at the Signature Theater. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Find today's stories and interviews from Laura Kennedy and Ryan Denham at WGLT.org. Find the full show podcast at our website or at iTunes. Try the NPR One app for GLT and NPR News. Get the app from Google Play or the Apple App Store. We want to hear what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can even call and leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.